Hello and welcome in.
Because he shows them the magic and mystery of science in everyday living.
On Science Mixtape on Soho Radio.
Hello and welcome to Science Mixtape with me, Kyle Major. Einstein supposedly said that without bees we'd have only 4 years left to live, but I prefer the observations of Professor W.W. Cook in 1887, which were that the safety of England depends on the number of cats she keeps. Without the aid of bumblebees, the red clover could not be fertilized. Bumblebees make their nests on the ground, where they're the prey of mice. Cats destroy the mice and give the bees a chance to live. Hence, no cats, many mice, no bumblebees, no bees, no clover, so no cattle, then no beef, and without beef, where would the Englishman be? My guest today is Dr. James Mackinson, researcher in bee behaviour and communication at Queen Mary University of London, where he studies many aspects of a bee's life, swarming, foraging, and the odd waggle dance. So thank you so much for joining us, James.
Nice to be here.
Great. So let's kick off. How did you get into bees?
So actually, back in undergraduate, I got a pet colony of stingless bees. So in Australia, we have 11 different stingless bee species. And I had this colony in my backyard. I used to watch it every day as all the little bees were out foraging. And I became really interested in them. And then when it was time to start thinking about master's and PhD, I found a bee lab at my university, which was keen to have me join. So that's how I started working on honeybees, basically.
So started as kind of like a backyard hobby and then continued. That's amazing. It's great. Since lots of people get into science in lots of different ways. You started out doing science in your backyard, which we encourage everyone to do. But so before we get into the real science, we're going to start with a little brain teaser here. And so our brain teaser is kind of a riddle. And this one is probably less serious than some of the ones we have. So don't guess yet, James. We're going to wait and see if people get it as the show goes out. Okay. And the riddle is, there is a bee in my hand. What is in my eye? That is, there is a bee in my hand. What is in my eye? So if you know the answer, do tweet us at Science Mixtape and get involved. We're going to kick things off with your first song, James, which is Distant Sun by Crowded House. Is there a reason you chose this?
Basically, it just reminds me of home and road trips with my family as a kid. So
here we go. Apparently honey use and production have had a long and varied history as an ancient activity. In Valencia, Spain, a cave painting depicts humans foraging for honey at least 8,000 years ago. So I guess humans and bees have been around quite a long time. And I think the thing people know most about bees is they're kind of a social insect to a greater or lesser extent. And really that's based on communication. And that's kind of the things that you're looking at. How do bees communicate?
Yeah, sure. So actually, just a quick correction there. So there's 25,000 different bee species, but actually 90% of them are solitary. So of that 10%, they have very diverse ways of communicating to each other, from leaving pheromone cues, vibrational signals, so shaking each other. And then the most famous of the communication systems that many people have heard of is the waggle dance in the honeybees.
I've heard of the waggle dance. You're saying that lots of bees are solitary. So is there are there differences in the way they communicate between solitary bees and bees that live in colonies? And when you say solitary, do they actually live on their own, or do they live in kind of groups, or how does that work?
So for the vast majority of them, they live by themselves. So the female bee will do all the provisioning for her own batch of eggs. the male simply mate, and there's not really much interaction between different individuals within the species except for communicating that they want to mate and sometimes competition for mates. So for most bees, they live a pretty solitary life. They're not communicating to each other at all.
So yeah, they're not really communicating when they're on their own. But bees that are in a hive, obviously they have to communicate. And you mentioned there's waggle dance, which is something we've heard of. What is a waggle dance, and why is it useful? What do bees use it for?
Right, so the waggle dance is a fascinating communication system because it's the only example of a referential communication system outside of humans that we're aware of. And basically, honeybees use it to communicate both the distance, direction, and the perceived quality of food sources or potential nest sites. There's two main phases in a waggle dance. Basically, in the darkness of the hive, if you imagine the vertical combs stacked up next to each other, the returning forager will produce a vibrational side-to-side shaking of abdomen while moving forward in a particular direction. And after she does this waggle run, she will loop around and continue and perform another waggle run. So this is where it gets a bit complicated. Basically, in the darkness of the hive, they can't directly point at where the food source is, so they dance relative to gravity. So if you imagine a food source out in the field and the sun's current position, maybe it's at 2 o'clock from the observer.
Yeah.
The bee will take note of that angle between the food source and the sun and then transpose that onto an angle relative to gravity within the hive. So it's actually a very complicated system that the bees use.
Okay, yeah, it sounds pretty complicated, but it's essentially they're communicating the direction that they want to go in just to find food, right?
Yeah, basically. So the main thing that they're indicating is the direction and the distance of a food source, and then the amount of times that they do these waggle runs indicates how keen they are about the food source. So if it's something they really like, they might do 100 or more circuits at any one time. But if the bee's not very motivated by the, maybe it's not very strong sugar solution, then they will only produce a couple of circuits.
Right. And so you said that they also use this kind of communication for finding new nest sites. And that's something you've done research and looked into in the past. How does that waggle dance apply for the kind of nesting sites?
Yeah. So when a colony wishes to reproduce, they have to do it as a group. So the old queen and about 10 or 20,000 individuals will take to the air and form a swarm cluster near the natal colony. So from the swarm cluster, the bees then have a really specific task. They have to go out and they find a new nesting cavity for the colony. And so individual scout bees will search the surrounding environment for large, dark cavities. And if they are of sufficient quality, then they'll come back to the nest and start trying to get other bees to follow them out to see this this location that they've found. And basically, activity builds up and up and up over time until a certain threshold level of interest is found for this new site. And then the bees return to the nest. They use a different communication signal. It's called the buzz run. So they run energetically through the swarm cluster, and that initiate swarm departure. So the bees all take to the air and travel in a group to their new home.
So do they decide via a democracy? Like in this, does the queen have a particular role? Because obviously she has a particular role in the reproduction of the hive. But in the decision-making process, is she kind of more involved or just the same as another bee in the hive?
So actually, the queen doesn't have any role in the decision-making process. So all she is basically is a walking pair of ovaries. So she's laying a few thousand eggs a day. And apart from that, she's not directly controlling the behavior of the individuals. So decision-making in this system is a collective process. And there's no one decision individual that decides for the whole group, but multiple individuals, based on their limited understanding of the surrounding environment, will pull their knowledge together and reach a collective decision.
Right. Okay. So, when you're kind of thinking about this, do you think of the hive as kind of the hive as a kind of big organism that takes on more, I don't know, than the individual bee itself. I seem to think that when you have like big swarms like this, you have big colonies. It's almost like the colony itself is an organism rather than the individual bee. Do you ever think like that when you're studying these kind of things, or is it just an individual bee acting inside the colony?
No, that's a really good point. So there's a term that we often use, which is a superorganism. So basically the collective can be viewed as a single individual. And certainly from a reproductive perspective, these swarming events that I was talking about are analogous to, say, for solitary organisms reproducing. And if you separate the individual workers from a colony or the queen from the colony, they won't live more than a couple of days without the rest of the hive to take care of them. So definitely the collective can be considered as a single unit known as the superorganism, and that is the bees have to be together in order to keep existing, basically.
Yeah, and so I think I read a little bit about that. At different points in their cycle, the workers have like different roles, and they do things like they share food with one another, and only certain bees go out and find food, and they kind of all feed each other. Is that right within the hive?
Yeah, definitely. And so workers, the task that they perform are based on the age of the individual. So young bees will be nurse bees, and they'll look after the grubs and the larvae. Whereas once the bees are reaching the end of their life cycle, they start doing the really risky behaviors like foraging. So every foraging trip is quite risky. You have to find forage sources, come back, and there's a risk of bad weather and predation. So the honeybee colony kind of deals with this selective pressure of a dangerous task by issuing it out to the grandmothers of the colony, basically.
Right, the ones that they can afford to lose, really.
Yeah, exactly. So sending at that stage, they only have a couple of weeks left in their life, so they go out and do the most dangerous tasks.
So really, that means that the honeybees that you see flying around, they're all the ancient ones, really.
Yeah, pretty much. They're definitely the older individuals in the colony, for sure.
Brilliant. Well, I mean, let's have your next song. You've chosen Robots by Flight of the Conchords. Was there a particular reason, or just really like this one?
I just really like this one, so it's kind of poking fun at a dystopian future where humans have been destroyed.
The distant future, the year 2000. The distant future, the year 2000. The distant future, the distant future.
It is the distant future, the year 2000.
We are robots.
The world is quite different ever since the robotic uprising of the late 90s. There is no more unhappiness.
Affirmative.
We no longer say yes.
And that was Robots by Flight of the Conchords. So the study of bees, which includes the study of honeybees, is known as melittology. Do you ever actually use that word, James?
So there is one journal called Melittology. I've never published in it, but I'm definitely aware of the term. We don't use it too much, to be honest.
No, it's one of those obscure terms that I don't know, people who don't study bees probably use to describe people who do study bees. So the kind of techniques that you're using must be quite varied, because I don't know, do you get inside a hive? Because a lot of this activity for the kind of bees that you're studying must happen inside. Do you do research kind of in the field? Do you do it in the lab? How do you go about finding out the things that you're finding out?
Sure. So my PhD days, I was studying Asian honeybees. And you're right, the waggle dances tend to happen inside the hive within the European honeybee, which is a bee that you see for honey production all around the world. But there's actually 12 different honeybee species, and the center of Apis diversity is in Asia, so that's where I did my PhD work. And the species that I was studying are a group of different species known as open nesting bees. So in contrast to the cavity nesting Apis mellifera, these bees produced single comb colonies which hang below branches and often on cave walls.
These aren't in like dark holes or like the eaves of a house like you would normally find. They're just kind of out in the open.
Yeah, exactly. They're usually just hanging off branches and trees.
Oh, right.
And the advantage of working with these bees is that you can see all the behaviors taking place right in front of your eyes. So you don't actually have to open up the colony or do anything complex like that.
Oh, right. So the bees are actually on the outside of just a comb that's hanging.
Yeah, that's right. And so one of the species I was studying, the most primitive of the honeybee species, they actually dance on a horizontal dance floor on the top of the colony. And unlike mellifera, which dances relative to gravity, these bees just directly point at that food source. So it's really easy to understand what they're dancing for and be able to follow the whole decision-making process. So basically, for my PhD days, I was just using a video camera. But these days, I'm based at Queen Mary. We're using the harmonic radar system to track foragers and reproductive individuals within the colony. So we're using a truck-mounted radar system that we wheel out to the field site. And then we have a small 16-millimeter transponder that we stick on the back of the bee. So they have this little backpack, and they fly off into the field. And using the radar, we can track their movement patterns with an accuracy of about plus or minus 2 meters. So it's relatively accurate.
Yeah, that's pretty good. And so you have to get these bees first and attach this little backpack onto them. How many do you do this to? Are you doing this for, you know, a significant portion of a hive, or are you doing this on other bees, on maybe solitary bees?
So our previous work to date, we've been focusing just on individuals. And one of the most exciting studies that we've produced so far was tracking individual bumblebee workers from cradle to grave, so every single flight that they ever performed in the landscape. So for some bees, so one bee in particular, there was about 180 flights over 5 days, and the bee was foraging approximately 300 meters away. But this upcoming field trip, we're actually interested in looking at what the whole colony is doing. So we'd like to mark every single individual in the colony and then kind of produce heat maps to see what parts of the landscapes are particularly attractive for the whole colony and the individual dynamics of how bees are interacting in the field. In order to bring in all the resources for the colony.
And you're saying this is with bumblebees. So these don't have these colonies of tens of thousands of individuals. Are they a bit smaller? It's a bit more manageable.
That's right. So bumblebee colonies. So unlike honeybees, bumblebees will only have a maximum of about 300 individuals within the colony at the peak of its cycle. And bumblebee colonies are annual. So the queen will found a new colony in the spring, and then all the individuals would die off by the winter.
Right.
And so it makes it really easy to mark every individual in the colony, because there's only a few hundred at any one time.
You see, I was always told that bumblebees were like solitary bees, but it's just that their colonies are actually quite small. So maybe you don't stumble across a big colony that often.
No, and they're quite cryptic as well. So they tend to either live in thick grass or in little holes in the ground.
Right.
So, yeah, it's very difficult to find them in nature, basically.
And so you're looking at tracking these individual bees. What kind of things are you looking for? Are you looking at, like, behavior, whether they prefer certain plants, or what are you looking for?
So I'll take one study as an example. Basically, we're looking at how they use different landscape features. So in a study that we're actually writing up right now, we were tracking the males and the queens in honeybee colonies. So we wanted to look at how they discover each other within the landscape and in order to mate. So actually, honeybees have really interesting mating biology. The queens will live for up to 5 or more years, but they only mate once in their life. And so a colony, when it wishes to reproduce, will rear some queens, usually about a dozen or so. But they also rear a few thousand drones, so male bees. And these male bees, they congregate in specific points within the landscape known as drone congregation areas. And basically, they spend their very short active life. So they have about 9 days of flight activity, and they spend that hanging out in these specific points within the landscape and waiting for the queens to turn up. And what we wanted to understand is how they're finding these locations. So these locations persist over multiple years, despite the fact that every individual dies off every week or so. So we wanted to understand what independent rules within a landscape the drones are using to find these mating points and to find their queens there.
So is it that they're looking for specific characteristics of the sites? Because obviously there can't be that much memory because they die off.
Well, exactly. There can't be any memory because individuals aren't living very long. So what we think is they're homing in on large emergent features within the landscape. So, for example, in the UK countryside, it might be a stand of trees within a field system. And basically, drones from up to 5 kilometres away will meet at these points and wait out for the queen. So that they can travel really long distances, and we think basically they're looking for the large, most emergent feature within the landscape to congregate.
Wow, it's amazing that these tiny little bees can think about it that deeply. So one other thing that you've been that we were talking about before we started recording was you're looking at having mixed species hives. I didn't know this was a thing. What is this? How does this happen?
So the majority of my work is more practical, but sometimes I like to do some interesting blue sky research. It doesn't really have a practical outcome. But for these mixed species colonies, what I wanted to understand is how honeybees learn to waggle-dance. So how an individual bee comes of age and decides to become a forager and dance. And I wanted to understand how important a role social context plays on how the bees exhibit their behavior. So what I did is I got red dwarf honeybee colonies. So these are small bee species that produce a dinner plate size colony. And as I was saying previously, they're the most basal bee within the species. They physically point at where to go with the waggle dance on the top of the colony. And then I added bees, giant Asian honeybees. So these are actually the biggest bees, and the individual worker is about 3 times the size of the dwarf bees. But they dance on the vertical surface, typically on the side of the colony. And so when I reared these individuals on the dwarf bee nest, I wanted to see whether or not they would learn from their host sisters where to dance, or whether or not they'd create their own dance floor down on the side of the colony.
Kind of nature versus nurture question.
Yeah, exactly. And so what we found is despite these bees being 3 times bigger than their sisters, they joined the sisters up on the horizontal dance floor and did their dances with their Floria sisters.
All right.
So it suggests that even in honeybees, nurture may play an important role in how individuals express behaviours.
And they can have that learning because these colonies persist over many years. Like the queen lives for 5 years, so there are individuals that live year to year when this happens. Do you think there's maybe the same process when you have these smaller colonies, like with bumblebees? Do they do the same sort of dance, or do they just forage on their own?
So bumblebees don't perform a dance. Honeybees are the only group of bees that produce this communication system. But all these bee species, they are using social learning to see what other individuals are doing in the field. So, for example, a bumblebee might be feeding on a flower, and a naive individual who has no experience in foraging will be flying past, notice the other bee feeding on the flower, and think, I want to see what all the fuss is about. And she will learn from this social interaction that flowers have a reward, and I can approach them in the same way that my conspecific did. So, yeah, that actually opens up in a really interesting question. How much does a culture have to do with behavior within even insect societies? There may be an element of culture in how behaviors are expressed.
It's amazing. It's really fascinating that bees have cultures, which is really good. I think we're going to... Well, we're going to move on to your next song, and that you've chosen Grew On Me by Tim Minchin. This is another good one. Any particular reason?
So this is a nice love song that my partner really loves, and she wants to play at our wedding one day.
Well, okay, great. Well, this is Tim Minchin with Grew On Me.
So this is a song about that creepy-uppy kind of love. Thank you.
me like a tumor, and you spread through me like malignant melanoma, and now you're in my heart. Should have cut you out back at the start.
That was Grow On Me by Tim Minchin. So honeybees obtain all of their nutritional requirements from a diverse combination of pollen and nectar. Adult worker honeybees consume 3.4 to 4.3 milligrams of pollen per day. So I'm not so sure on my bee facts here. Did you know off the top of your head whether that's about right, or am I over-egging it there?
To be honest, I have no idea. I mean, it sounds pretty reasonable to me.
We're just going to assume it's correct then. That works for me.
Yeah. I mean, if it's on the internet, it must be true, right?
Exactly. It all is. So before we were talking about this culture of honeybees, but actually bees are really important for human culture and for cultivation especially. Is what your research doing kind of feed into that industry? Because I know that we consume honey, but also bees are massive pollinators for many other crops as well.
Yeah, definitely. So insects pollinate about 30% of the crops that we eat. So they have a really important role in industry. And what we're primarily looking at in my current postdoc is space use in bees. So how bees are using the landscape to mate, to migrate, and just to exist, basically. And it has really important implications for how you designed agricultural systems. So we have a big problem globally at the moment with a biodiversity loss throughout the world, basically due to agricultural intensification. We're clearing natural land to replace with monocultures. And our studies looking at how foraging bees, how far they forage, and how they're using different resources can allow us to make predictions about what levels of intensification are going to be harmful to pollinator populations. And then the flip side is how you could design landscapes so that pollinators can persist and continue providing their really important environmental functions.
Right. Okay. Yeah. You want to kind of design a farm so that you can have the hives in the right place, essentially, really. And you're not going to affect the environment too much.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what we're aiming for, yeah.
Yeah, of course. It's quite amazing that it feeds so much into something so important like the production of the food we eat. So on the show, we sometimes try and do a bit of an experiment where we try and, do a demonstration or something like that. And we were kind of struggling to think of one that were to do with bees, but I came across this thing called Heidinger's brush. And so me being a physicist, I feel like I'm going to try and describe what Heidinger's brush is. And then I'm going to hand over to you, James. You can tell us why this Heidinger's brush and why this, what it shows us, is actually important in bees. And so Heidinger's brush is an optical phenomenon that happens in your eye. And it's to do with the formation of proteins in the macula in your eye. And what it means is that when you're looking at light, which is polarized, and what that means is the electric field of that light is oscillating in one particular line. So you just see the electric field pointing one way. When that light enters your eye, there's a distortion effect, and you can see a very small object in your vision. And so this object is about the size of your thumb, and it's about, when you hold your thumb at arm's length, it's about that size. And it looks a bit like two yellow balloons pointing outwards with their knots towards each other. And then in 90 degrees to that, two blue balloons pointing outwards. And the two blue balloons actually point along the direction of polarization. And so what we're going to try and do is see if you people can see this. So one really good way to look at it is actually if you look at a laptop screen or an iPad or something like that, because the LCDs in the screen are polarized. So the light that comes off of it, if you look at a large white area of a laptop screen, for instance, and you stare at it for long enough, you start to see these kind of like bubbling pictures appear, and then hopefully Heidinger's brush should appear in your vision. And another way that you can see this is actually if you look at the sky. And so if you look at 90 degrees to the sun in a blue area of sky and you stare very, very hard, you can actually see polarization. And it's very faint and you have to practice if you want to do it, but that's something you can try next time. It's a nice blue sky. Try it. But this thing of seeing polarization is important for bees, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. It's really important for pretty much all insects that fly about during the daytime. So the sun's rays leave a pattern of circular pattern of polarization throughout the sky, and bees can look at these polarization patterns and be able to work out where they are within the landscape at any time. And also, once the bees return to the nest, they can actually memorize the path of the sun throughout the sky in order to produce these wagon dances accurately throughout the day to indicate a static point, despite the fact that the sun is constantly moving. So honeybees need to see just any small patch of the sky. As long as a little bit of the blue sky is poking through the clouds, the bees can perceive the polarization patterns that are coming from the sun and work out what time of day it is and whereabouts within their landscape they are. So it's critical for them to find their way home, basically.
They that means they use this polarization as a kind of compass, so they know where they're oriented and where their hive is. And obviously, this you said this is important. They do their waggle dance relative to these angles, right?
Yeah, that's right. So naive bees, they need to learn this, but basically, very quickly they pick up on how the pattern of polarization changes throughout the day. So that if you they disappear into the darkness of the hive, they can still work out where the sun should be at any one point in day, just due to their internal clock keeping track of where they perceive that the sun should be.
So have they done kind of research looking at trying to change this polarization? Does it actually affect the way that the bees orientate themselves if they've done it in a kind of false way? Do you know of any research that's doing that?
Yeah, so actually with my PhD study organism, the dwarf red dwarf honeybee, Apis spherea, they do use sun's polarization to orientate their dances on the comb. And if you actually remove the polarization cue from the hive, so you put a big sheet over the top of the colony so they can no longer see the sun, they can still use landmarks, which they've been able to see from the nest, to orientate their dances. But then if you also shift the landmarks, then the dances become completely chaotic. Basically, they try and home in on the landmark, the local landmark, and try and, they presume that the sun's position is based on this feature, which is now shifted, say, 180 degrees. So we know through simple behavioral studies like this, which are done back in the 80s, that the polarization is basically crucial. It's the primary orientation system that the bees use. They do have backups for cloudy days, but it is the primary navigation aid that they're using in the field.
So what are these backups? Are these, as well as kind of the land sites, do they have any other ways of navigating that you know?
So we know that they can also detect magnetic fields. So there's less literature on this, so that's actually an open area that needs more research, but we do know that honeybees specifically can detect polarization. They also take into account the surrounding landmarks, and we know that they do have some sort of magnetic sense. So it hasn't yet been shown we know that pigeons use magnetism to orientate themselves when they're flying in the sky. But with honeybees, we don't know for sure yet if this is a mechanism that they consistently use.
Yeah, there's some fascinating studies where they covered the one eye of a pigeon and stuff, and they think that there's maybe some cells in the back of the eye that can detect magnetic declination, I think. So maybe there's something similar in the bee. We're going to move on to your next song, which is Creep. Now, I mean, not Creep the song, but not by Radiohead, but instead by Richard Cheese. Why this particular version? Why not the Radiohead one?
I like his upbeat attitude. Richard Cheese has got some great covers of often very sad songs, but he always makes them sound happy.
You know, folks, I was talking with my honey the other day, my Pablo honey. I said to her, I said, Pablo honey, I said, You go to my head, my radio head. Okay, computer. When you were here before, couldn't look you in the eye. You're just like an angel. Your skin makes me cry. You float like a feather in a beautiful world. I wish I was special.
So that was Creep, not by Radiohead, but by Richard Cheese. Apparently the sting of the queen is not barbed like a worker sting, and the queen lacks the glands that produce beeswax. Once mated, queens may lay up to 2,000 eggs per day. That's quite a lot. We were talking about the queens earlier, and you're saying that they live for 5 years. But there was also a thing I heard, which was that the workers are free, the queen are their slave, which kind of seemed to apply in the relationship you were talking about earlier.
Yeah, I think queen is really a misnomer. She definitely doesn't have any power over the rest of the bees, except for creating them. But yeah, she's basically the reproductive organs of the colony.
So what we're going to do is, we're just going to go straight on to your next song, Common People by William Shatner. Again, like a different cover version. Do you have a thing for covers? Or?
Oh, I'm obsessed with Shatner, actually. It just happens that he's done this great cover. Yeah.
It is a great cover. Here it is. This is Common People by William Shatner.
She came from Greece. She had a thirst for knowledge. She studied sculpture at St. Martin's College. That's where I caught her eye. She told me that her dad was loaded. I said, in that case, I'll have a rum and Coca-Cola. She said, fine. And in 30 seconds' time, she said, I want to live like common people. I want to do whatever common people do. I want to sleep with common people. I want to sleep with common people like you. Well, what else could I do? I said, I'll see what I can do.
And that was Common People by William Shatner. The honeybee's venom is known as apitoxin, and it carries several active components, the most abundant of which is melanin, and the most destructive is phospholipase A2. Yeah, get there. So these long chemical names, sometimes a struggle. How accurate was that one, James? That was our last fact of the day. So how are we doing on the facts?
Well, it sounds pretty accurate. I don't really study venom, but definitely it sounds like it's correct.
Brilliant. So the one thing I was going to ask you, which is something that I kind of assumed was a problem or thought was a problem, which is this idea of something, the disappearance of colonies called colony collapse. But you told me that actually this is a bit of a misnomer. It's not really colony collapse on the scale that people are concerned about. What's going on, and why is it what we know different from what the public perceives?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, so there was a lot of concern. I think it was around 2006 when there was a particularly bad year for colony declines in the US. And so colony collapse disorder is definitely a phenomenon. Basically, when it occurs, all the workers abandon the queen and the brood, and they just disappear. And then the queen and the brood die off. And there are a number of factors which we think cause this disorder. It could be anything from pesticides, the intensity, agricultural intensity in the surrounding area, mites and bee viruses. But actually, it's turned out that it's not the massive issue that we thought it was previously. So honeybee colonies have actually been increasing basically since the 60s globally. And so these cases of CCD were primarily in parts of the US where they have really intensive agricultural practices. So, for example, the yearly almond pollination system, where they truck in literally millions of colonies into the specific part of California to pollinate the crops, the almond crops over there. And this is a really unnatural system where you've got a really high density of honeybee colonies in one location. So it's a perfect scenario for spreading of diseases and basically just stressful living conditions. But globally, we do actually have an issue with pollinator declines. So specifically, what is really concerning is solitary bees and native bumblebees seem to be declining in many parts of the world. And we think, again, there's a lot of issues such as agricultural intensification And even honeybees and commercial bumblebees could be playing a role in terms of spreading diseases to the native bee populations.
Is there anything where they're kind of like competing for resources, and because, you know, honeybees are looked after and maybe they can sometimes do a bit better, they can kind of outcompete these smaller, more native species?
Yeah, so there is experimental evidence that says that, honeybees do outcompete the solitary bees. And we definitely see the same with ants. In ecosystems where you have big social insect colonies like ants, they tend to suppress the diversity of solitary insects in the surrounding area, just because it's much easier to compete with other species when you're working as a collective.
Yeah.
So certainly, I don't want to paint a bleak picture where honeybees are actually the problem. That's definitely not the case. They're really necessary for pollination of commercial crops. But I think that something that's kind of misrepresented in the public, mainly due to a bit of a lack of understanding, is that the bees that we should be concerned about declining are the solitary and native bumblebee species. They're the ones that really are, some of them are going extinct.
Really?
Yeah.
So, I mean, is there something that people can do, you know, other things that people can do, like within their gardens or within, you know, other spaces to maybe encourage bees to be, because obviously we need them. We need them a lot for pollination.
Yeah.
How can people help out by making, you know, maybe making different choices?
Yeah, definitely. There's a lot that individuals can do. You can plant bee-friendly plants in your garden. And so it's really important for the native bees that you plant locally native flowers. Often people have these beautiful ornamental flowers in the garden, but they may be hybrids that don't produce pollen at all, or perhaps they're bird-pollinated flowers or mammal-pollinated flowers. So from a bee perspective, they're not actually useful. So if you really want to make a difference in your local ecosystem, what you should be doing is planting species that are local to the area and also providing nesting substrates for these solitary bees.
Well, brilliant. That's really helpful, and hopefully we can keep our bee populations, up and on the up, continuing in the future. Thank you so much for coming on, James. And this has been really interesting, buzz through the area of bees. How can people get in touch with you if they want to follow or find out a little bit more about what you do?
Sure. I'm on Twitter. My handle is James Makinson at Twitter. And you can check out my lab's webpage. So I'm in Lars Chitka's Bee Behaviour Lab at Queen Mary University of London. And on there you can find links to what we're up to at the moment in terms of experiments, and you can see other members of the lab as well.
Brilliant. So we've just got time to have our riddle for the day. So maybe we'll have our guest. There is a bee in my hand. What is in my eye?
Beauty is in the eye of the bee holder, I guess.
Exactly. Oh, it's terrible, isn't it?
It's worthy. Terrible.
terrible. Anyway, it's only left me to thank you one more time, James, for joining us this week. Thank you. Remember, we're live on Soho Radio every other Saturday, and you can follow us on our social media at Science Mixtape. If you want to listen to some of the shows again, you can just go and find them on your trusty podcast provider. We're going to play out on James's last song, which is Thank You for Loving Me at My Worst by The Whitlams. Why do you choose this one?
It's a nice goodbye song, and it reminds me of the Olympics back in Sydney when I was a kid. It was blasting on the microphones all around the Olympic venue.
All right, well, here are The Whitlams. Thank you and goodbye.
But we got there.